quick announcement. Linguistics Career Launch 2024 is happening this summer. It will be a two-week event taking place online from July 15th through July 26th, 2024. This is a boot camp that takes linguists in training and in transition from coursework to career through panels, courses, guest speakers, and networking events. Check out our website at linguisticscareerlaunch.com for more information, and then join us July 15th to the 26th, 2024, to access the career management methods you need to research and apply to jobs that use linguistics in business, government, nonprofit, and tech. Brad Davidson is a linguist and medical anthropologist with extensive experience in marketing, positioning, branding, and overall customer and patient provider experience. He received his PhD in linguistics from Stanford University and worked as a professional namer before moving into life sciences and healthcare marketing. He's currently employed as the Senior Vice President of Medical Anthropology at Havas Health, and he hosts the podcast called Breaking the Code. Topics covered include applied linguistics, medical anthropology, medical linguistics, naming, branding, networking, research, and medical communication. Also, content warning, there are some swears and discussions of medical conditions and treatment. Links to Brad's LinkedIn profile and other resources are in the show notes. Brad Davidson, thank you very much for joining me on the podcast today. It's a delight to speak with someone who I probably knew, but now am talking to in real life.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me, Laurel.
I am so intrigued by the career path that you have followed and that you are in medical anthropology now, which sounds really fascinating. So let's start at the beginning, and I would love for you to talk about how you got interested in linguistics, because I see on your LinkedIn that your undergrad was not in linguistics. So how did you find out about linguistics?
Really good question. But first thing I want to say is we both work in naming, and we have a lot of people in common. Medical anthropology, I'll just throw it right out there, right, is one of my greater naming achievements, because for many years, I called myself a medical linguist, and that sounded a lot like homework to people. But medical anthropology gets a lot of questions. So even that small word change has been a very, it's been an eye-opener, right? I think since we're a linguistics podcast, I would say linguistics has a branding problem. It sounds a lot like we're going to be diagramming sentences today, and that tends to turn people off. But not me, not you. We like diagramming sentences, but something like anthropology is a little more evocative, and I think we'll get back to that idea throughout this whole thing, which is how do we package up what we know how to do for consumption outside of the world of linguistics, which, by the way, is not a unique problem to linguists. Scientists in general have a hard time communicating about science. So
totally. And linguists even more so, because as you say, there's the one thing, which is diagramming sentences. And then the other thing is, how many languages do you speak? And that's pretty much anybody, all they would say about linguistics, when it's just so much more and touches everything. So
right. And the third is like, so you're going to teach Spanish in high school? It's like, I have to support my family. Wasn't the goal, but there's nothing wrong with it. So so, okay. So you asked how I started. So it's interesting. I've always been interested in language. So there's that. It wasn't like an interest in language developed out of like a thunderbolt out of the blue kind of thing. I mean, I remember as a kid, I don't know how old you are. There used to be a children's magazine called Cricket, and I would submit like poetry to Cricket. I was really interested in writing, what sort of production of language. I read a ton. So, you know, it's sort of like a typical future academic background, like a little nerdy, little Dungeons and Dragons-y kind of stuff. But what I was most interested in was politics, to be honest with you. And I was very interested in the politics of language. So I had always been, you know, studying Spanish and all that stuff, and it didn't really coalesce around that interest. I was much more interested in history and politics. I was in Europe in the late 80s, and then stayed in Spain from like 89 to 93, I think. And that was just sort of immediately post-undergrad. I was just like teaching English, you know, translating, opened a bar, just kicking around, having a good time. And what was interesting is several things came together at once in that. So one of those lessons of like, if you're not totally directed in where you're going, you can actually end up where you want to be. So I was interested in politics, and Barcelona has a huge language and politics issue with Catalan. And that was very top of mind when I lived there. I was teaching English, and unlike most of the other English teachers I was working with, I was like, well, I might as well learn how to actually teach. So I went to a lot of teacher training for EFL and ESL. And so those two things kind of came together. And at about, I don't know, early mid-20s, I made a personal choice that I had spent enough time sort of kicking around on foreign shores doing really nothing. And so applied to grad school. And I have to shout out John Rickford here. He was the head of the admissions committee at Stanford the year I applied. And they didn't really accept people to do a master's into that program. It's too expensive. And they had made the decision correctly that nobody really gets jobs with a master's. Nobody really gets jobs, but they didn't accept people to do a master's. And John made exceptions. And there were three of us that he brought in who had what they would call probably non-standard linguistics backgrounds. And I will say all three of us finished our PhDs. So John had a pretty good eye for like who could be, but it's a little bit of a money ball thing where like, well, they don't look good on paper necessarily. They didn't do linguistics undergrad, but they're clearly interested in language, and they're clearly interested in language in a way that would benefit the department, and the department would benefit them. So I was let in on that kind of weird wrinkle. If John hadn't been chair of the department at that point, I probably wouldn't be in. But after that first year, when I got my master's, we were all accepted then into the PhD program as a continuation. I taught English the entire time I was there to help pay for it. So anyone at Stanford whose English is suboptimal is a graduate student in engineering or science. So, so there's a huge number of, say, Taiwanese engineers and Japanese earthquake engineers and, you know, Venezuelan petroleum engineers that I was busy sort of teaching the whole time I was there. So I never really lost touch with the sort of practical applied end of things. And that might be part of why I feel the way I do about the field of linguistics right now and in the academic setting. I'm choosing my words carefully. I think one of the more damaging things that linguistics has done is looked down on practical application, that theory and practice can't be along the same axis. I never thought that. I don't have any problem with, say, studying grammaticization. I really enjoyed that. Scott Schwenter was in my cohort. He's the chair of the Department of Spanish and Portuguese down at the Ohio State University now. And, you know, he wrote endlessly about grammaticization, you know, the sort of, I'm trying to do it in a, like a simple way, but evolution of language kind of stuff. And I think that stuff is really interesting. And I remember having a conversation with Scott one time that, like, he thought what he was doing wasn't particularly useful. I was like, well, it's not useful. It's just sort of interesting. I actually felt like what I was doing was directly useful, though.
This is something that is still going on. So 100%. We have heard, so the group that I'm in, the linguistics career people, have repeatedly been told when we've wanted to offer classes or programs or seminars or something in applied linguistics, you know, how to apply your linguistics to your job, you know, here's how to you know, write a chatbot or to do something that's really applicable in the real world, the response is that's not linguistics.
This is a family friendly podcast, so they can they can take that and stuff it, right?
I'm now old totally enough,
and I'm independent enough that I can go, that's one of the stupidest stances that academics can take. I understand that they don't want things to be super duper applied, but I'll give you an example. Xerox PARC was paying for several of the dissertations that were being written at Stanford at the time, right? They don't mind applied stuff. They just want like the science-y stuff. And I don't know why that's preferred over the social science stuff. But so my dissertation came about in the following, again, sort of serendipitous. In the middle of all this, I will say, whenever anybody asks me about my career, I always say the best way of thinking about my career, and I put big air quotes around that, is every time I took a step forward, a rock showed up in the middle of the you know, the misty river, and I didn't splash into the water, but there was no visible career. I just went from job to job. And that might partly be why I've sort of been buffeted around a little bit, but also why I've ended up in some interesting spots. Like I've been open to serendipity. So here's a serendipity. I was very alienated during the sort of middle of my postdoc, not my postdoc, my doctoral studies. And I think that's not a unique feeling. I think people mm-hmm. start feeling very lonely and alienated and under the gun, and you're sort of like no longer the best student. Now you're the bottom mm-hmm. of the professional mm-hmm. food chain, and that's very yeah. disorienting. And so I recommend volunteering. So the secret to a happy life is being of purpose, not hedonism in my world. So I volunteered as an interpreter at the local hospital, and immediately was struck by how completely messed up the entire situation was, that I've been given like 3 hours of training. I mean, I had been a translator. I was fluent in Spanish, but you know, very few ethical sort of considerations before taking a 25-year-old and throwing him in the deep end. And on my first day, I was interpreting for a woman whose child, a Quiche Mayan Indian immigrant, illegal immigrant, whose child had a brain tumor. And I was having to translate this. And it was way over my head. And, you know, the more I looked into it, the more I realized that I'm not the only person who's noticed, you know, Foucault famously noticed, you know, birth of the clinic stuff, that there's three institutions where people come into contact with the modern state. And one of them is hospitals, and the other mm-hmm. are courts, and the other are schools. If you're an adult immigrant, you don't go to school. And if you're lucky enough to avoid the courts, that leaves hospitals. And so I did my study in hospitals. I studied doctor-patient interactions when there was an interpreter. I did both the hardcore linguistics of patterns of interpreting through, you know, patterns of communication through hospital interpreters, very sort of detailed study there. But I also did like, what's the social and linguistic gatekeeping role of mm-hmm. an interpreter who's really an active interlocutor? And so examples abound of things like, just because you speak Spanish doesn't mean you like each other. If you are white, urban, from Mexico City, and you are interpreting for Mayan Indians for whom Spanish is a second language, you may produce the utterance, "Oh, they're just like children," which is exactly what I heard someone say. So, oh my God. You know, it's a fascinating field. But also when you start getting into like border studies, immigration studies, again, like, people need healthcare, and so they're gonna end up in the health system. And it's a fascinating area to see what the Hmong or Tongans or, mm-hmm. you know, any name a group. And anyway, so what was interesting, and to get back to this applied thing, was I did apply to language. I submitted an article to language. One person said, "This is a great article." And then in classic academic fuck up fashion, they actually sent me the reviewers, review comments, the open reviewers. I know who said this. I could tell you today. I'm not going.
Oh, no. Oh, and my God. Okay.
Said, right, one of the very seriously heavyweight, you know, mighty famous big shots, whose name I won't mention, but I know exactly who it is and will never forget, wrote, not to me, but it came to me, that this is the kind of work that is of no interest to linguists, and that should probably might be of interest to an interpreter, but really he couldn't see why anyone would want to publish it. I did not send a dead rat to his house. I took that as that's a joke, folks, but I did take that as a sign that like the work that I was doing was not going to be terribly respected. That was a blow, mm-hmm. because I thought it was good work. And I will say, it's, I don't know if it's petty or if it's like something that I need for my own ego or whatever, but he was wrong, because I look at that article, I put it up on one of the free sites, and I look at the article all the time, and its p-value, its impact factor, is higher than any other article anyone in my cohort wrote ever. So
take that.
Back of that. So take that. That, I mean, that yeah. and a nickel gets you a pickle, right? But it's, you know, it's interesting to me that people who are within academia, at the same time that they're saying we really need to help our students get out into the real world, it's not even that it has to be applied, it's that they literally block applied work, or yeah. or if your work has an application, it's suddenly suspect. It's
yeah.
I didn't set out to have an applied thing. I thought it was theoretically very interesting. I mentioned Foucault. There's a lot of really interesting institutional modern state dynamics that go on at hospitals that are worthy of study, but as soon as somebody thinks like, well, it's just about hospital interpreting, I guess it goes in the Journal of Interpreting. Like, you didn't even read the article. Like, what's wrong with you? So that, so all of you looking to get out of academia. Yeah. That's one thing. Like sometimes they're not even reading the article. Anyway. So, yeah, I did do a job search. It did not work out. I won't mention the universities, nor will I mention what happened. I did get offered a tenure track job. It was far too far away from where I lived at the time to make it worthwhile. Immigration was something we were working through. And then I found out that my wife was pregnant. I didn't just find that one out, but I found out that the country we were going to wasn't going to allow her in because they considered pregnancy a pre-existing condition. So I emailed the faculty that I was going to and said, look, can we push this out like one semester so I can be present for the birth of my first child? And they wrote back, we can't do that because you're teaching all our classes. We're all going on sabbatical. In fact, it's probably a blessing she won't be here because you'll never see her. And don't worry, because you probably won't have to change any diapers, big smiley face.
Oh, so, my God. Oh.
Yeah. So you can imagine how I reacted to that. You've only known me for like 10 minutes, but I was like, nope. So that was
my blood pressure. My blood pressure is just rising as you're telling me all this. It's making me insanely angry.
Well, yeah. And the funny part is think about what I just said. Like it was a successful job search by almost any metric, even in 1999 or 2000. I did get a postdoc, so it was probably 2000. You know, even by 2000 standards, getting a tenure line job offer was the brass ring, and it would have paid nothing. I mean, nothing, nothing. And they weren't going to let my wife come, and they were trying to sell me that it was a good idea. And I remember thinking, we're in theory going to be colleagues for life. Like this is a tenure track job, meaning I might be with you for 25 years. I will never forgive you for this. So there's no point in me coming. Like I will never not resent.
Yeah, of course.
And of course, it's the most unreasonable thing to say to a junior faculty member waiting for their first kid as like, well, kids are a nuisance while you're trying to get tenure. Mm-hmm. Like I don't want to live in an environment like that. So, but that said, I will take a breath and I will say you and I talked before this podcast. That was one of the most difficult decisions in my life. And I have not told this story very often, but I remember sitting in San Francisco on the couch. I am not a big crier. I sat on the couch and I cried. And I remember saying to my wife, I was just telling, she was like, what's going on? And I was like, well, I think I'm going to turn it down. And we had like a going away party. My parents had like done all this stuff. We had done all this stuff. And I said, I can't take it. And then I just started crying. And I said, I would have been a really good academic. Like I love teaching. I love writing. I love, you know, research. You don't go into it for the money. I just wanted dignity and a living wage and an ability to support my family. And that just all seemed like, who the hell do you think you are? Like the guy who's not going to do this anymore. That's who I am. So that was hard. It never has stopped being hard. I just went to the LSA last week because it was in New York and I work in Midtown and they needed. They needed moderators for the different, you know, panels and whatever. And so they sent out a link, you know, a note. And I said, yeah, I'd be happy to do it. I can just walk over from Madison Avenue and, you know, go to Midtown Hyatt, I think it was. And I got there and just a flood of emotions hit me. And I ran into John and I ran into Penny Eckert, my other advisor. Shout out to both of them, the most amazing academics I've ever met. And, it's bittersweet. It remains bittersweet, you know, that I feel very successful in many ways, but that was what I saw myself as. So I still teach a little. I write a lot. I have a podcast, and that's where I've really been able to sort of express my interests most freely these days, like everyone else. But, you know, no matter the fact that I've had a 25-year career outside of academia as a linguist, it still stings. So those of you who are looking at it as like, should I stay, should I go? You got to separate that out. Like, I think that idea of like the good old days that never were is very applicable to academia right now. I grew up around academics who had a good life, who were given housing allowances, whose children were paid for to go to school, who would swap houses with academics over the summer. So they would go to Norway for a summer, and some Norwegian faculty would come to Connecticut, you know, for a summer. And you had a sort of monastic life in the sense that you didn't have a lot of cash, but you had access to some great monasteries. Mm-hmm. That's what I thought of universities like. And that's just not, that doesn't exist. Like if that's what you're looking for, you're going to have to find it in some other way, because universities are no longer places where academics comfortably do academic work. They are institutions where money is made by doling out education, and academics are sort of the factory workers. So that's that. I can't overstate that shift. And that has got to do with stuff that I study today as well. Doctors are in the same boat. We're in an era of deprofessionalization where doctors don't run hospitals, MBAs do. Academics don't run universities anymore. And if they do, it's really more administrative academics. They make flipping outrageous amounts of money. And the reality is, if, you know, going back to linguistics, if you think of universities as a place for people to do academic work, then Hittite poetry makes sense. Because where but at a university could you study Hittite poetry? But if you think of a university that sells education as a product, and that's all it does, except for maybe make, you know, tons of money off of patents, if all it is an institution that sells education, no one studies Hittite poetry. Maybe three people every 10 years. And so there's no reason for you to be there. And so we've sort of allowed the academy to become a place where academics aren't welcome. And there is nowhere else to study Hittite poetry. And that is obviously a metaphor, but you can fill in whatever you want.
I have to cut in and say one of my best friends in graduate school studied Hittite poetry. That's what he did in linguistics. He loved it. It was great. He was very good at it. And after he got his PhD, he finished. He's been working in a library because there are no jobs. And
there are no jobs.
He wasn't willing to, you know, move to Heidelberg or wherever there were, or Turkey, where there are very, very few jobs, but there were at least some jobs. And so you can now say this is not a metaphorical story. This is a real story. There's a real human being behind it.
For all one of you studying Hittite poetry right now at the doctoral level, there used to be a home for you. And the thing I tell people all the time in industry, and I haven't even gotten to the industry part yet, but the thing I tell people all the time in industry is you don't go into linguistics because you want to get rich. You know, now there are certain types of linguistics, I guess. If you go into, you know, natural language processing now, you might you might be thinking that you could make a boatload of money somewhere. But the reality is most forms of linguistics are really to understand humans and to understand how we, you know, just the ins and outs of communication. I don't have to tell linguists why they're studying linguistics, but it ain't to get rich. So, you know, when you get into industry, you're around people who went to B school, you're around people who took jobs partly because they just had an opportunity to make a lot of money. And so you are in with a group of people. Now, I'm not saying I'm not a dilettante, right? We're business people. I'm a business person and have been for the majority of my life now. But my motivation is not the same as, say, someone who just wants to get rich so they can marble the third bathroom on their third yacht kind of thing. You know, like I do work in pharma. I don't necessarily do backflips when I find out that the CEO of Gilead Pharmaceuticals got a $50 million bonus because of how well they did. Like that part of it bothers me, but it bothered me when I found out what Condoleezza Rice made at Stanford. So, you know, it's like, it's all part of the same thing. I think the money talks these days, and the idea that there would be a class of knowledge workers, let's say, we're in an era of robber barons again.
Totally.
And they don't give
and- us- Yeah, they don't give a shit. And also, you know, you were talking about universities and hospitals being run by, you know, B-school people or whatever, but also venture capitalists who are sort of the worst of the worst because they will kill things to extract a profit from it. And that's happening with universities. You know, universities are being closed because they're just not profitable enough, which is insane.
Well, they're not profitable enough because they've sort of they've stopped paying faculty, but then they've started paying administrators, and then there's a ton of administrators.
Right.
And the other thing that people need to recognize about universities, there's a couple of things. One is there is an entire, here as social scientists, there just aren't as many Gen Z students as there were millennials. Mm-hmm. And so the sort of eye of the needle through which education has passed all throughout my children, I have three kids, as they went through their schooling in the little tiny New York State town that I live in, we went from 4 elementary schools to 2. We almost went to 1, but the parents lobbied against that. So we didn't need 4 elementary schools. We had built several new ones for the millennials, and we didn't need them for Gen Z. And as we go through their aging, it's interesting to watch people. It's almost like watching the wave at a collegiate football game, except for it's like people shocked that they can't find hires. And it's like, right, you can't find people to be baristas because we're missing 10 to 20 million of the age cohort compared to the millennials. Mm-hmm. You can't find enough people to join the Navy. You can't find enough people to fill in the blank. It's like, because they aren't there. Because they're, you know, and so we've got a good 10 years of lean times for universities before Gen Alpha comes through again. And we don't know how many kids the millennials are going to have. But let's say that they sort of ballpark it the same as everyone else, will be short universities again, unless, and this is what you talked about with venture capital, unless we manage to hollow out the value to such a degree that $70,000 a year for something that doesn't necessarily net you back the money sort of right sizes universities, and we get more people learning welding and that sort of stuff. So who knows? Right. And it's all sort of, this one, I'm not a PhD and I just am a consumer, but yeah, I watch it very carefully because it's the conditions of my labor.
Yeah. I want to circle back to just a little bit when you were talking about the situation that you found yourself in and how you were treated and all that. One of the things that I have tried to communicate to linguistics departments, because our group tries to liaise with linguistics departments, they are so clueless about the situation that you and I have just been discussing, A, number one, but also they're clueless about how to communicate with their students about the reality of it. So all of the things that we've been talking about, you know, the lack of tenure track jobs and how difficult it is to work and all that, none of that is being communicated to most students at most linguistics departments. People go to linguistics because they love language, like you and I did, like everybody does. But nowhere in your career are you ever told, hey, listen, the chances of you getting a tenure track job are near zero. So maybe think about doing something else. It's a pretty dire word. You're there, you're getting your PhD, and everybody's like, oh, you're so smart. You'll get a job. There aren't too many jobs, but you'll get one of them. And I feel like that's morally wrong, right? Like, students should be given the facts.
So I'm, funny enough, for a guy who's known as being a bit of a sharp-tongued critic, I'm going to give them just the tiniest bit of a pass, not on what you said. They do owe their students the truth, but the fact that they don't know what else to do is directly related to the fact that most of them have never left the academy.
Correct. Yes. Agree. 100%. Yes.
And that you can't really fault them for it being theory. You know, now they've watched some of us go through. What I would fault people for is watching people go through, come out the other side, and not inviting them back. And you and I have talked
about
that as well, but, you know, I've made the offer several times. Again, there seems to be a little bit of cognitive dissonance. So again, people I respected tremendously, people who were mentors and remain mentors and frankly idols of mine, were capable of saying things like, well, cream rises to the top. You know, and the sort of implication being, if you don't get it, you're not cream. And I'm like, you understand, you're supposed to be this famous Marxist scholar. You understand the concept of alienation, right? That you are no longer in the control of the conditions of your own labor. How do you not just run the numbers and see that there's too many people in my cohort for the jobs that are opening, let alone all the other linguistics departments that are about to unleash PhDs? Like there's... In the game of musical chairs, when you have 1,000 kids in 8 chairs, like, it's not a very fun party.
Right, right. Exactly. So what we've been trying to do when we're communicating with these departments is to just get them to do some of the basic work, like, hey, track your students, track your alums. Where are they getting jobs? Maybe that would help. Extend those invitations to people who have gotten jobs.
again, I might be excusing people who I'm fond of, but it's just such a paradigm shift. I don't think they've caught up with the idea. It took me years being in industry to figure out the paradigm shift, which is you're not really king of the hill just because you got the validation, the union card, as they call it. I was told that my PhD was a union card, and that I, by someone who was very, very astute, who was one of the academics who did fully understand the situation. He said, without that union card, you're not going anywhere. So finish the PhD. And he said, but then also, like, that PhD, that union card isn't as valuable outside, but it has value. So I've mentioned my graduate alma mater several times. I didn't for years. Not just modesty, just like I don't really believe in that. Like, just because you went to, you know, XYZ, there's all sorts of jokes. Like, how do you know if somebody went to Harvard? Don't worry, they'll tell you. That kind of thing.
Right.
Like, I don't want to be that person. On the other hand, in industry, and we both work in branding, the Stanford name carries weight. So I use it.
Sure.
Does it always work the way I wanted it to or thought it would? No. So here's some very practical advice, right? Because we should get to the practical advice.
Yes, yes.
So one piece of practical advice is, if you come in with a PhD acting like you're doing people a favor because you were going to be something else, but you decided instead you're going to slum it and go into industry, which is simple, you're going to get crushed, because the people in industry don't think it's simple, and what they want to achieve is not simple. In fact, they compete every day to try and get to the top of the ladder if that's what they want to do. And they go out to dinners and they spend a lot of time of their lives trying to groom themselves and put themselves in position to succeed in business. And if you walk in with the attitude like that's the plan B for you, that is on an emotional, cognitive level going to turn people off. Mm-hmm. And I have to be honest, I'm sure I did some of that because I didn't want to be there. I did want to be doing something else. So that's one. I think the other is, you know, we often get very defensive. We're wounded and kind of bruised when we leave the academic job market.
Yes.
And so we're not as, you know, hurt people kind of thing. And so we are probably better at certain skills than other people. But what makes an academic is the ability to sit and read and write. That is only one part of a business job. Emotional intelligence is very important. I think having a clear idea to what the objectives are, an ability of everyone involved in whatever project you're in. And the bigger the project, the more you have to negotiate goals and objectives. And, you know, sometimes it's just a matter of learning where your piece of the puzzle fits. And that takes a long time. It will take you a long time. It is not something they teach us at all, is how to work. It's not a team sport being an academic. It just isn't.
Right.
Business is all team sport.
Yeah, totally.
And you know, I think the last thing I'll say is you have to be able to translate your knowledge into something that's usable. So we were talking about the podcast that I just started last year with my partner, Sonika Garcia, my work partner. I don't think I would have been able to do it any earlier than I did it. Because I think a lot of the high concepts that were very obvious to me, what I couldn't do was translate them effectively. So for example, the concept of disease versus illness. Now I'm sort of going out of order here because I haven't told people what I do yet, but I work in healthcare communications for the moment. The idea of disease versus illness, the way that people like Elliot Mishler defined it, is disease is the pathophysiological process, the signaling cascade in your brain that creates migraines, right? The hypersensitive brain overreacting to normal stimulus. Illness is the experience of living with disease. And the major disconnect in many doctor-patient interactions is doctors are talking disease, they're talking pathophysiology, and you are talking illness. You as a patient, what it's like having a migraine, how it affects your life, how it makes you a, you know, 9 out of 10 migraine patients are women. So makes you a bad mom, makes you a bad wife, makes you a bad coworker, makes you unreliable, all this sort of guilt that comes along with it, the anxiety that I might get a migraine attack down the road and all these sorts of things. All of that has to do with illness, not disease. And the major problem in medicine these days is that we are good at treating disease and not so great at treating illness in America. And if I could have said that the way I just said it when I first entered into healthcare communications, I'd be a lot farther along in my career. But it takes a long time to learn how to speak to a new audience. And so those three things, I think, like, you know, come in with some humility. Your skills are translatable, but they're not immediately translatable and no one's going to help you. Come in with the idea that the team sport part of it is what you need to learn, and come in with the idea that once you do learn the ins and outs of business, you are now a dual threat and a unicorn. You know, there aren't too many PhD linguists running around in my company. Funny enough, there is one other one who just showed up, but that's like the first time in my career. So there are lessons to be learned, and it circles back to the professors we have. How could they possibly know that? You know, they didn't go through it.
Yeah, totally agree. And all of the things that you've just been talking about, some of the other guests we've had on the podcast have echoed that as well. The importance of being a team player and learning how to work with other folks, incredibly important. One of the other things that goes along with being a team player, which I'd like you to talk about, is the whole networking thing, which we as academics are not really well versed in, but which is incredibly important in not only getting jobs and finding out about jobs, but working in the ecosystem of industry, because it's all about who you know and who you communicate with and the little transactional things that happen in between them. So going back now chronologically to after you decided to leave academia, how did you find the jobs that you subsequently had after it?
So the first one I'll just sort of like throw out the window. It doesn't matter. I was in Silicon Valley during the dot-com period and they were hiring people hand over fist. I didn't learn anything at it. It only lasted a couple months and it turned out to be a Ponzi scheme. So lesson learned there. But you know, so I guess one lesson would be like, if you're in an internet bubble, like, yeah, get a job. Just don't expect to retire.
Sure.
But the real first job was the one that you and I had talked about, that Will Laban, a linguistic angel.
Yes.
He is a phonetician. He is also the chair emeritus at the Stanford Department of Linguistics. Mm-hmm. Now, many people were chair emeritus. They actually viewed it as the booby prize. They didn't want it. So you had to do it on a rotating basis. But Will did a smashing job as the chair. And as often happens, there was sort of a very unexpected connection between Will and industry. And I think, you know, I think people feel guilty about their breaks. Don't take them. You only get a handful of them, you know, and I'll give my spiel as to how you can make it right. If you get a break, how do you help the people around you? Don't just be a taker. That's the other thing, is industry is a give and take. We tend to get very greedy and selfish in academia. There's no downward pressure on that. There's no end of greed in the academic world, I've found, for credit. You got to give and take. So Will is super generous, was working for a naming company that you and I both know in Sausalito, and they needed someone, and I was desperate. I had a wife with a child. Because of the job I had had beforehand, they hadn't paid our insurance. That child was born without health insurance, which was scary and not at all in keeping with my approach to life. So didn't want that to happen again. So I worked for a company that was a naming company, which, again, you know, like everybody goes, linguistics, naming, like there's a lot of business involved in that. And what that ended up being for me those 3 years was a crash course in branding. And branding is very interesting to a linguist, because branding is all about symbolic meaning. What does a brand mean? What do Levi's mean? What do Coca-Cola, what does Bud Light mean? What happens when Bud Light puts a trans person on the can, and then what's his name, the idiot, shoots the cans of Bud Light. And, you know, like, it's fascinating to be party to all this sort of stuff and to think about the sort of symbolic meaning of a lot of things. And so branding is all about symbolic meaning. It's all about, you know, naming is really all about getting the right language. And I turned out to be not the world's best namer. I'm not terrible, but I'm not a professional grade, let's say. But what I was a really good researcher. I'd done a ton of field research, and I became their principal researcher, and as such was able to say this name will resonate with this audience, because remember, we're a bunch of middle-aged white dudes naming things like Xbox Live. We didn't name Xbox, but we named the feature Live. And I remember having some of the worst brand names I'd ever thought of for that feature. So when it launched, it was unique, you know, no one being able to talk live to your competition and go, I just smoked you. That was not available. And it was being launched with Xbox. And we had to name the features. And I remember thinking of like, I just remember one being like Outworld or Nether Stadium, or just like really trying way too hard. And doing some research in San Francisco in front of a game store. And this was the kind of fun thing. This was the kind of thing where I realized like industry can be fun. I went into the game store and I said, listen, I want to research some names with your biggest customers. I don't have time to get permission from your corporate lords. I mean, all of this is well past the statute of limitations, right? So I don't have time to go to your corporate headquarters and get permission. So I'm not going to be on site, but I am going to sit outside your door on this little park bench here, and I'm going to buy $500 worth of gift cards in $50 increments. And just as your best game customers come through, tell them they can get a gift card of $50 to your store if you just spend a couple minutes talking to me. And who do you think ended up being the best game people? Who got all those cards? Every one of those cards went to one cohort.
I don't know who.
The people who worked there. It was the first finding. It was just like a record store, like game stores at the time.
Sure.
If you were a gamer, you worked at a game store. Just like if you wanted to find a record head, you'd go to a record store, and the guy behind the counter was the record head, you know? So, so that was funny. Anyway, they all were like, wait, we can talk to each other live. Just call it live. It was like one of those moments in Sling Blade where he goes like, ain't got no gas. Like, it was so obvious to not overbrand it.
Sure,
so,
of course. Yeah.
Right. But we all get wrapped up in our own underwear a little bit about the naming thing. You can try too hard and come up with something Rococo or Baroque and fall in love with it. And they were just like, call live. So, you know, it turned out I was a very good interviewer, a very good researcher, because I was able to sort of, they said lots of things. They didn't just say call it live, but the one that resonated was call it live, you know? So, so that translated well into learning about industry and how it worked. I also continued to learn some bad habits. It was a very small company with very few checks and balances against egos. And really, we had to survive against one person. So now hurt people, and then got further sort of blasted. And so became sort of like one of those shivering chihuahuas you see in one of those commercials late at night, like, please pay, give to the ex-academic fund, and, you know, super hand shy and snappy. And I went to the next job I got, we left the Bay Area and I moved to sort of New York metro area working in pharma, because I had a background in doctor-patient interactions, and I've been there ever since. And I will say that I was so poorly socialized into non-academic practices. And then the 3 years at the naming company were so traumatic. I mean, I was threatened. Do you remember when there were phones on the back of seats in airplanes?
And they yes.
Card and they'd come out and it was expensive. Mm-hmm. I remember my boss felt a need to swipe and pull the phone out to yell at me for 10 minutes. Because I went and taught a class that we had negotiated that I could teach when I first started. And it was just one threat after another to my job. And I remember just going, my wife was pregnant with our second kid. I remember going like, whatever I need to do to keep this job, I will do it, you know? Mm-hmm. And fear is just a tremendous motivator. And so, you know, I muscled through that. But when I got to what I would think of as a sort of normal corporate environment with HR and everything else, very quickly I was sent to remediation. I will put it that way. And I don't say that with any shame or embarrassment. They were just like, you're very talented. And if you continue working with people the way you work right now, you won't be here. Mm-hmm. And so I was also complimented on one of the only people who actually turned that stuff around. Like, I literally had not been taught how to behave in meetings. Mm-hmm. Now, you could say that's on me. I'll own 100% of it, but I was able to learn it. So even that, like the fact that the company that took me on, now they might not have done that had they not paid to move me too, you know? So like at some point you're in for an investment, you kind of got to follow up on it. But that always stuck me too. Like, just how close am I to being unmanageable as an mm-hmm. academic, like as mm-hmm. someone who views themselves as an academic, who views themselves as their ideas are the only output that matter. It turned out to be so false. Any idea unexecuted is useless. A bad idea well executed at least has a chance of doing some good. So, you know, I very quickly had to sort of change how I viewed my role, and that was humbling. I'd already mm-hmm. felt like I'd been humbled 50,000 times along this journey. And so you just got to get used to it. Like, nobody's going to go, oh, thank God the linguist is here. We were so stupid before you got here. And now, you know, like mm-hmm. that is not going to happen. You have to convince people. And the thing is, it shouldn't be that hard, because what is marketing if not words and pictures?
Exactly. I say this all the time. I think that there should be so many more linguists in marketing, because it's all about words and images and the semantics of it. And who better to do that kind of stuff than linguists? I want to just comment on a couple of things you said, and then I want to ask you how you got that job in New York. But first, I think one thing we've talked about a lot on this podcast is this idea of moving from job to job to job, which most people do, and which is very uncommon in academia, right? You get a tenure track job and you're in it for the rest of your life. In industry, the model of moving from job to job to job is quite normal. I don't like the term job hopping because it has some negative connotations, and I wish there was a better word for it. But you learn things at every job that you work at. And I too have had the experience of working at a small firm that had a megalomaniac, a narcissist at the head of it, and
damaging sociopath.
All of that stuff. And although it was horrible in many ways, I learned so much.
You do.
And it did some things for me that I took through to the subsequent career that I had that I don't think I would have gotten if I'd started at a kindler, gentler kind of place. I don't like to say things like boot camp, but it can be beneficial. So for, you know, when people are evaluating their job options, it's good to have different experiences. So maybe work for a big company, maybe work for a small company or a mid-sized company, like try things out and see what's going to be a good fit for you.
I had a really interesting interaction when I was looking to get out of academe. So my postdoc was winding up. It was clear it wasn't going anywhere. And I took what was used to be kind of called like the millionaire's run. I took the flight from San Francisco to Seattle, right? That mm-hmm. run during the sort of late 90s, early 2000s was like mm-hmm. the billionaire's run kind of thing.
Yep.
And so I was interviewing at Microsoft, and I sat next to a guy, and as happens sometimes, I started talking to him. It was like out of a movie, and he was an older dude, and he gave me some really good advice. I said, I have this, you know, you asked, you know, what got me to the East Coast? And he said, I'm going to interview. And he'd been at Microsoft for a long time and wasn't there anymore and stuff. And he said, basically, long story short, the window of opportunity for you to make a difference in how Microsoft works is closed years ago. It's mm-hmm. too big. Mm-hmm. Any one person is not going to make a difference in it, but it's very stable. The window to make changes to a 10-person company, which I was going to a 10-person division inside of a 500-person company, it's like that window is wide open. You can be the change that you want to be. And I remember mm-hmm. that really mirrored some advice that Ron Scollin, a linguist who I admired tremendously, who died far too young, had said to me the same thing, that when you looked at Ron's career, he ended up at places like University of Hong Kong. And University of Hong Kong for a while was a real hotbed of sociolinguistics. And it turns out he went there following his wife, and he said, make it. view yourself as the change, you know, mm-hmm. like if it's not on the map, put it on the map. And so, you know, I think that motivated me. The way I got the job was totally serendipitous. It was one of the only times in my life that a cold resume actually worked. Mm-hmm. And it was there was a division at the time that was studying doctor-patient interactions. And then they had a very large project where Spanish language was important. And so they wrote a job. I swear to God, it was like they'd been looking over my shoulder. They wrote a job description. They wanted somebody who had studied doctor-patient interactions, Spanish a plus, a linguist, and somebody with at least 3 years industry experience, which was at the time like me. So mm-hmm. I think I was the only person who applied for this job and got it. And that's not going to happen. Like sometimes there's breaks, but you know, going back to the Will Laban thing and going back to this idea of being greedy and all the rest of it, I will say this. There are connections in the world that get you jobs. And it's almost impossible to apply to something cold and get a job. That doesn't matter if it's academia. That doesn't matter if it's outside of academia. Somebody has to vouch for you somewhere. Now, my children were sort of the mindset that that is nepotism, that it is unfair to people who don't have contacts. They're wrong that it's nepotism. They're right that contacts are unavailable to many people who historically weren't in industry. So one thing I will say is I feel like I can do a lot more good even when it comes to ensuring that people who don't have the same privileges I did growing up have a more equal shot at getting the jobs. I can't get anybody an academic job. I can't get myself an academic job, mm-hmm. but I can get people jobs who come from historically marginalized backgrounds. And then I can introduce them widely to people mm-hmm, inside mm-hmm. the company. And I mm-hmm. always make a point of doing that. And there's somebody who's 23 years old who reports to me now, and he's from Queens. Very, very smart guy, but again, doesn't have the sort of list of contacts that I have, but given the background that he's from. He's an African-American guy, just sort of like different world, you know? Mm-hmm. I've made sure that when we have certain initiatives internally, that they're his to run so that people can see his name mm-hmm. and get to mm-hmm. know him. And that, I think, you know, again, people tend to think of corporate America as somewhere where you can't do the good work of creating equal opportunities mm-hmm. and removing barriers and redressing historic inequities. You're wrong. You can. In fact, you're in a better position to do mm-hmm. it in an industrial place because there's more opportunity there. There's more Absolutely. Money, there's more jobs, there's more chances. And I have become very conscious of the power, and I don't mean this in a sort of like, I'm power mad. I mean, the power I have to connect people to things that they wouldn't be connected to otherwise, mm-hmm. even inside my own company, it far exceeds the good I would have been doing as an academic trying to place two or three people in a career, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And you join the long list of people who I've interviewed who have said exactly that same thing, especially with regard to linguists and linguistics. So in many companies, the linguist that I talk to is the first linguist that they hired there. And yeah. once they're there, they immediately start evangelizing for why you should hire more linguists, which is often very successful.
I'm all about this. This guy's not a linguist at all. He's just a marketing kid, but you know, mm-hmm. but he's an African-American marketing kid who doesn't have the contacts, who doesn't have the mm-hmm. friend of the friend kind of stuff going on. And so that's some of the most valuable thing we can give people is yeah. that contact, because I don't think people are going to change. I think you want to get somebody vetted by somebody, you know, friend of a friend is a real thing.
Yes. Yes. So building your network, incredibly important, and it's something that we recommend to all the folks who are currently in academia as they're starting to look out to where they're going to be getting jobs, is to start building your network now. So get your LinkedIn account, get it up to date, start Yes. making connections with people, start talking to people, start, you know, whether you're volunteering like you were talking about before, you know, get people who know who you are and what kind of job you can do. And then when you start going out there onto the market, you'll have this network of people who in almost 100% of the cases are people like you. You know, you want to do good. You want to help people. You want to give them that hand to get in there. And I know this, you know, we've been criticizing academia an awful lot, but I will say I find that so different from the academic model where people are not really willing to help you very much because it's such a closed environment and there's so little in terms of resources. The people that I interact with in industry, almost everybody's like, sure, I'll vouch for you or I'll put your name in or whatever. Like people just want to be helpful.
Yeah. I don't want to sell people a false bill of goods, right? I mean, there's something called the sociopath in the corner office or the psychopath in the corner office.
Yes, this is true.
There is a well-studied phenomenon that if there are five people vying for the CEO job, the one who's going to get it is the one who knifes the other four in the back, mm-hmm. right?
This is true.
The further up you go the corporate ladder, the more people exhibit sociopathic and psychopathic mm-hmm. tendencies. I don't mean they're mass murderers, but I mean that they're willing to, you know, go after their friends and stuff like that. So, sure. You know, you do have to be careful in outside of academia. People are people, but I would say, I think academics have huge egos. Lots of people do. I'm not pointing them out, but I think they tend to view placing people as reflecting on them. Not all of them, again, but many. And yes. I think part of the reason they're not that interested in talking to people who've been placed outside of academia is it doesn't reflect well on them because mm-hmm. it has no cachet. Yes. So I think in the middle of my career, now they might be able to point to me and go like, look, he's the director of medical anthropology and blah, blah, blah. Fine. I've always been that, you know, I've always been an N of one. Up until last year, the medical anthropology group was me. I directed myself, you know, we've now got a couple people, but I think you got to be careful promising people that they won't come across bad people in industry. You will. Mm-hmm. you will come across bad people who aren't interested in you in industry, but you'll also come a lot. It's a much fuller suite of people. And I have found my allies, let's put it that way, and the people that I'm comfortable with.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah. The other thing I think is think of your skill set, and people say this all the time, as a set of skills. But what maybe people don't say all the time is because you have to. And it's not just you, it's everybody you know. So I heard a thing a few years ago on design thinking. That's everybody talks about that these days, right? But this one person was talking on NPR. I think actually they were from Stanford. And they were saying, you know, somebody was asking about design thinking and jobs. And he goes, well, here's the thing. And this was years ago, you know, so for millennials out there, this is you. And you Gen Z, it's going to be worse. He said, the idea that you would have a job for 40 years and retire with a gold watch mm-hmm. is fanciful at this point.
Yes.
That the average person is going to have, and then the number just like floored me. I've never tried to validate it, but he said something like 40 jobs in their career, mm-hmm. which floored me. And he said, so when you think about it that way, 40 job transitions means what we need to be training people is to think about how do they package themselves in an ever evolving job market? Because mm-hmm. yeah, like the industry I'm in is rapidly evolving. Is healthcare going anywhere? No. Is working on behalf of pharmaceutical companies to communicate about their drugs going somewhere? It very well might. It very well might go away. Now, I often get accused of, not so much anymore, but of working for the devil kind of thing. You will find that you have to compromise when you leave academia. Mm-hmm. But put a pin in this because you will also find if you look back at your academic life that the institution that you came from was not as crystal pure as you thought it was. You know, Georgetown is grappling mm-hmm. with the fact that they sold a bunch of slaves to keep themselves in business not so long ago. But even beyond that, like you look at what the Hoover Institute does at Stanford. You look at what Condoleezza Rice was capable of when she was provost and shutting down mm-hmm. certain divisions that simply because she could. You know, I don't think these places are as pure as people think they are. And they're major, major corporate institutions. So I would say, even if you stay in academia, don't kid yourself. You're involved in everything is a consortium now. Everything is a conglomerate. And you have to make decisions about what you will or won't do. I have always felt that if I could help doctors and patients connect better, and I view doctors in some ways as part of my remit, doctors are miserable right now. There's so much information on this, but if you didn't know, suicide rates up, Dissatisfaction is way up. 1 in 4 doctors are planning to leave as soon as they can. There's so many changes in medicine. And it's got to do with, like you said, the sort of private equity bros kind of taking over. But, you know, you have to be prepared to move jobs, and you have to be prepared to continually reinvent yourself. Mm-hmm. But you don't have to continually throw out what you learned. You just have to repackage
it. Yes. Yeah. That's super important. Couldn't agree more about that. And it's a lifelong sort of thing. I think you and I are probably close to the same age, and I'm still learning and doing different things. And I'm sure you are in your job too. And I don't expect that to end.
I'm perfect.
Really.
I have learned everything I need to learn. I'm not learning another damn thing. No, of course there's more to learn, you know, like everybody's interested in AI and I'm like yawning at that, but at some point I'm going to have to figure out how to have at least a point of view on it. But I will say one of the best things about working in pharma is it is an age of discovery and wonder. And if you're not aware of it, those of you listening to this thing, we've quintupled survival in lung cancer in the last 5 years. We have created, we are on the verge of gene repair. I hate the term gene editing because it makes it sound like we're putting tails on babies or something. Like, let's fuck around with this, right? Like, no, like proper gene repair ethically is a little bit scary because we may end up, like, you know, deleting the left-handed gene or something like that, or the girl gene or whatever it is, right? But there's no question that things like sickle cell disease, hemophilia, all sorts of, you know, the BRCA gene, like they all, I'm conflating three different types of genes, but the fact that we can actually go in and look at genes and start monkeying with them, we can see a future in which we are changing those parts of us that make us sick. That's fascinating. And I'll tell you one more thing and go, like, if you think this, if you think working for pharma sounds tedious or whatever, there's something called CAR T therapy. It's a couple of years old now. It's difficult to manage. It's got to do with T cells, but for certain liquid cancers, they have managed to figure it out. And what they do is they take your blood and they send it to essentially a manufacturing plant, and they activate your T cells. So this is personal, it's your blood. And then they send your blood back, and then they put the blood in you, and you're sick for about a month, and then you're cancer free.
Wow. Amazing.
Right. That is science fiction. And as a linguist working in that category, the immediate thing, aside from the "are you kidding me" kind of science fiction-y coolness of it, it's called Kymriah, by the way, is one of them. K-Y-M-R-I-A-H, in case you don't believe me. But, you know, first of all, one of the, you get to interview doctors, and they're so smart. And so this one guy said, he was a pediatric oncologist, and he said, "I tell my patients I'm sending their blood off to ninja school. So when it comes back, cancer's ass," which is like, you're my hero, right? But the other thing is, think about it. Like, that's not a drug. That's a manufacturing process. And so we call that a drug, but it's not. And we talk about adverse events, you know, like that, those are side effects in pharma speak, but they're not adverse events. They're reverse states, because we've just reprogrammed your immune system. They're not going away. So even the language of CAR T therapy, just like we call our pocket supercomputers phones, and they're not really used as phones very much, we are calling things drugs that aren't drugs. And I think there's a role for linguistics to help keep up with the advance of science, because right now the language is completely inadequate to convey to people what's going on. And that's true at the doctor level. That's certainly true at the consumer level. I think people are being faced with choices in their healthcare, the consequences of which they have no idea how to evaluate. I think that's on us to help them. We're not going back to the days when everybody had the same doctor in the same town. You ask people today, who's your doctor? They'll tell you what healthcare system they belong to. That's part of medical anthropology more than medical linguistics, right? But it does speak to the relationship you have with your doctor, which means you can't shorthand anything, because you don't hardly know them. They see you for 11 minutes. And so how are we going to get people informed about huge choices? How are we going to get rid of the shame and stigma around things like PrEP and HIV or alopecia? How are we going to get people to take Gardasil shots? So, fun fact, Gardasil doesn't just prevent cervical cancer. it prevents HPV anywhere you have sex, which means it prevents head and neck cancer. People just don't like talking about oral sex. It means that it would have prevented Farrah Fawcett's anal cancer that killed her, because nobody wanted to really talk about the fact that Farrah Fawcett died of having anal sex. Frankly, she wanted to talk about it. Nobody wanted to put it out in press. So we have taboos, we have stigmas, we have shame that prevent people from going to look for help. We have so much shame around mental illness and stigma, so much shame around menopause. You know, one of the divisions that I work with frequently is over in Manchester, England, and they're wildly creative. And they just came out with the, if we are roughly the same age, I will just say that I just got my AARP card. So any of you who are in the same band, they apparently, masturbation is a wonderful symptom reliever for menopause. Try and get women to do that.
Wow.
Right? Yeah. So they just put a huge billboard up in Manchester, like the prescription you'll want to do again and again, with all these sort of funny, melty letters. And of course, sex is funny and fun. We use it to sell all the time. But in reality, I don't know how many women in Manchester are going to look at that billboard and go like, I should go home and have a wank because I'm having a hot flush. Like, there is such a gap between the data and the behavior. And that is really where I think we can help. Look at what happened during pandemic. Look at how badly we handled getting people vaccinated. Look at how stupid and flat-footed we were. We did things like tried to pay people to get vaccinated. The assumption there was everybody was on the fence and we just needed to tip them over. They weren't. There are whole cohorts of people who don't trust the pharmaceutical and healthcare industries at all. And when you offer to pay them to get vaccinated, it just proves to them that there's something fucked with this one, that there's no way they would pay me to take a drug that wasn't somehow in their best interests.
And I will say, still doing a horrible, horrible job of communicating about the current COVID situation.
1,000%
There is a complete disconnect between the way that the scientific results are being reported, like COVID levels in wastewater and how many people are in the hospital, and the way that the government is trying to communicate about this. Like, where are the linguists here? Where are the people who are advising them? Like, the coherent ways to convey information to people. It's insane.
It's extraordinarily frustrating. And you start thinking like an interventional social scientist, you know, for lack of a better term. And you start going like, why are you ignoring the data? You know, why are you ignoring the fact that this clearly isn't working? But, you know, needle exchanges, I mean, everything.
Yeah.
And then you get into the situation that we are in a society that is rapidly evolving, and that taboos are changing. Interracial marriages are no longer as taboo as they were. Same-sex marriages are no longer as taboo as they were. Premarital sex is certainly not anywhere near as taboo as it was, you know? My dad says that when he was in college in the 50s, one of his classmates got his girlfriend pregnant and they threw him out, you know? So I think... if you haven't seen the Phexxi ad, P-H-E-X-X-I, it's sort of like a surreal moment for me where it's the woman from Schitt's Creek and she's having a party in her vagina and she goes, welcome to my vagina. And it has a couch and a Roomba. And it's, I'm like, what the hell? But clearly we are in a new era of talking about things that were shameful in private, which is great. But then we're also in an era where like, oh, we can talk about it. Well, let's have this woman from Schitt's Creek like using hedge trimmers to trim the entrance to her party cave. Like, it's fucking so weird. I'm telling you. And like, again, I'm not anti-creativity. I just don't know if it worked for a birth control ad. Like,
So Deborah Cameron, who is a linguist, a sociolinguist.
I know Deborah Cameron,
Yeah, she writes an amazing blog that comes out once when she feels like it. And she wrote a very long thing about a marketing campaign that was done in England to encourage women to get pap smears. And the imagery that they used was a pair of crossed legs. And the tagline was something like, you know, just uncross them. And it was so bad.
Yeah.
Because there's so much negative baggage around that. And supposedly the campaign was developed by a woman-led marketing team. But there's an instance where a little bit of research and a little bit of contributions from perhaps sociolinguists would have told them that that probably wasn't going to be a very effective
campaign. So you don't have to be a linguist to know that that's a bad one, right? And I think that's another skill that you can't necessarily put on your resume, but you can say, as you get better at, say, evaluating creative output, you can be a voice of reason. So I remember walking in to, we're sort of sticking to birth control, but I do think women's health is an area of greatest movement in my career in terms of what we can and can't say. Like once upon a time when I first started, I think, if not in, not long before I first started in the industry, if you wanted to advertise birth control, both parties had to show their wedding rings in the ads. And now it's like PrEP, like I play safe. And like the fact that play is used, the fact that sex is considered fun and play is just a wild difference, you know. But I worked on a vaginally inserted ring that was a birth control ring. A drug eluting ring, as they say. So it's impregnated with hormones, weird word, but and then it sort of releases them over the course of a month. I'm not going to name the product. If you use it, you know. And I remember doing, it was one of the first dialogue studies I did, and this was straight linguistics. We saw the doctor saying, we are offering it and nobody wants it. Okay. And then you videotape and audio tape interactions. And this is all straight social science stuff. You go, when am I going to capture a discussion of birth control? First postpartum visit. Because you always have a discussion of going back on birth control in your first postpartum visit. Excellent. So we record a lot of these things. And what we caught the doctors doing was saying the following. Well, we got to get you back on birth control. There's patches, there's pills, and there's this ring you shove inside your vagina if you're interested in that. And it's like, yeah, no one is going to say yes at that point, right? And also, it's a whole lot like going on a first date and going, I just got out of prison. Like, why are you putting the worst part of this thing first? It is the fact that you have to insert it inside yourself is the is not a feature of this. It's something you want to avoid. And I sat on a panel of like communication experts about how to talk about this shit. And this one guy, I'll never forget it. He goes like, here's how I do it. And he was like the biggest writer of this drug, right? And he goes, are you interested in the lowest, steadiest dose of hormones that bypasses the first pass metabolism, that has no breakthrough bleeding, that is 99% effective, that has 99% satisfaction, and you only have to deal with it once a month? And if the answer is yes, let me start talking to you about the fact that it's inserted in this and that, like, you know, establish value, then ask for investment. I'm like, it's straight linguistics. Like, start with the benefit.
Yeah, like, of course.
Why are you blurting out the worst part? For the same reason that we blurt out things all the time, because it's like primed in our mind that we don't want to say it. You know, moly, 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 mole. If you know the reference to, you know, Austin Powers, where it's like, don't mention the mole on the guy's face. So, you know, you can train doctors to not do that and to say, like, just lead with the benefit. And we did, and it worked. And like, I think those things make you feel very satisfied, even though it's just like helping women choose birth control. There's no just take the just out. You helped women choose birth control.
Right. Yep. Yep. Totally agree. Yet I've had a lot of conversations about taking the just out. I think I have been so enjoying all these anecdotes that you've been talking about, all these examples. And I think it really comes back to what you sort of said at the outset, which is that this particular area of communication, so marketing and branding and just straight up communication in the healthcare area is now and is going to be one of the biggest areas where language experts are so desperately needed.
Yes.
And I think the good news is that companies are recognizing it and are actually hiring people with the skill set that you have and that other people have. I helped name a company that actually does this. So they provide training and tools for cross-cultural communication within the American healthcare system. So
awesome.
Especially, yeah. So it's not just translation, right? It's about what are the cultural norms of the people that you're dealing with, and what are they comfortable talking about, and what are the ways and who we need to talk to make sure that they're getting the healthcare that they need. And they have said that the demand for their services is like skyrocketing. So
I imagine it is.
Yeah. So it's a tremendous area. So for people who are interested in this type of communication, there will be jobs for this sort of thing now and into the future, because without it, it's not going to work, right? We need people who have the skill set. And all of the things that you mentioned before, like not only being sensitive to language and maybe some idea about sociolinguistics, but also the ability to do research and collect the data and turn it into something that's actionable by the company.
Be a good consumer of bad research, you know, because a lot of market research is really poorly executed.
Yes, yes, it is. And we've all been sitting in on that. Yes.
Confirmation bias. It's full of like very flat-footed, like just because somebody says it doesn't mean it's true. It's interesting that they said it. It's important that they said it, but somebody telling you that they're going to prescribe something or take something doesn't mean they will prescribe or take it. In fact, it just means that that's what they thought at the moment that they needed to say. It is far more interesting to find the gap between what they say and what they do, because that is fertile ground for behavior change. And so, you know, the last thing I will say is it is true that we continue to train ourselves throughout our careers. And something, I think it was John, but I can't remember, but somebody told me we all end up training ourselves. You know, we all end up, as the field evolves, as the field moves, I am not a behavioral scientist. I'm an observational social scientist. I'm a descriptivist, as we say, but I have learned and read and worked on and in practical ways become much more of a behavioral change expert because that's what I'm getting paid for. And that's the skill set that I brought to it, the ability to teach myself some of these things and apply them. And so for those of you who are looking for work, don't despair. I will say it was never clear to me where I was going to go next. Never. You have to be comfortable with that. On the other hand, I have always, you don't need 10 jobs. You need one job at a time. And I've always found one. So, you know, stay the course, be humble, but be persistent.
Yeah. You're a linguist, man. You're good at stuff. You have amazing skills.
You're smart. You're disciplined. You've been put through your paces. You have more skills than you know you do. You just got to learn how to whom they are valuable when.
Yeah. Yeah. And how to package them.
Yeah.
I want to put in a plug for your really good podcast, which is called Breaking the Code. It's available on all the podcast platforms. I have to say, I like the format of it, the conversation that you're having with your co-host, and also that it's sort of nice chunks, you know, it's not 2 hours long.
So it's 20 to 30 minutes. I make it to 30, and Sonika tries to keep me short. And I will say that the tagline is taking the BS out of behavioral science. Largely, I get to vent my spleen about bad like ideas and social science research. I have a whole podcast on that whole, like, why did we try and pay people during pandemic? Like that literally was counterproductive.
So I highly recommend it to folks because, if you're interested in this sort of thing, this is a really nice look at some of the issues that get dealt with all the time and the things that you've encountered in your career. So just, I want to put that in. Can I put your LinkedIn profile in the show notes in case people would like to contact you for advice?
1000%.
That is awesome.
I feel committed to the field. And like I said, it never stops hurting. You know, I'm old, my kids are out of the house and I still, it's still regret. Right. So, but I do feel like service to my fellow linguists is one way of maintaining connection and utility. So, you know, leverage that insecurity that I have. No, I'm kidding. But I'm more than happy to help. I mean, people gave me a hand up. Be generous with your time and your ideas. That's the last thing. Like, if you're a linguist, if you're someone who really is a good academic, ideas will come much easier to you than most people. Be generous with them. It's execution that matters.
Yeah, that's great. Thank you so much, Brad. This has been such a great conversation. I really appreciate you taking the time to chat with me today. I think the listeners will find this incredibly interesting.
I hope so. And if there's anything else I can do, just let me know. Again, Laurel, thank you for, you know, providing an explicit sort of platform for people to learn about, like, what we know is useful. The trick is finding where and when and how it's useful.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
I often say to people, about half of what I'm going to tell you in today's meeting will make for interesting dinner party conversation, and the other half will be business useful. And I'm not sure which is which. And it usually gets a laugh, but it gives me a bit of a like wiggle room to just say whatever's on my mind. But frankly, it's true. Like, some of what we know is just interesting. Mm-hmm. And some of what we know is not only interesting, it's practical. We don't know the difference.
Exactly right. Yeah, that's great. Thanks, Brad. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Laurel.
Linguistics Career Launch 2021 was a one-month intensive program intended to familiarize linguistics students and faculty with career options beyond academia in business, tech, government, and nonprofit organizations. Videos of all our recorded sessions are available on our YouTube channel. LCL 2021 was organized by Nancy Frischberg, Alexander Johnston, Emily Pace, Susan Steele, and Laurel Sutton. You can get in touch at linguisticscareerlaunch@gmail.com.